You're listening to Section D, first broadcast on the 10th of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. Today, for the 100th episode of the show, we're in Paris for this season's edit of Design Fair Maison et Objet. We'll be talking to you about the finds we've been cherry-picking. First up, Monocle researcher Josh Fennett will be chatting to Sheridan Coakley, founder of London-based retailer and manufacturer SCP.
We just try and use the materials that are traditional materials in interpreting things in a kind of contemporary way to make things fit into the way we live now.
I'll be speaking to two giants of the Finnish design scene, Marimekko and Itala, on what they are launching at the show.
Part of the interior concept that we are going deeper into is also storage, not that just lamps. Klaus Aalto and Elina Aalto, who make together design company Aalto plus Aalto, they have made us a wonderful storage solution on plywood.
Plus, we'll be chatting to Monocle contributing editor Alicia Kirby as she recaps the best of Maison 2013.
The trend from last season of pastel colours is still quite strong. So a lot of ceramic ware in pastel pinks, pastel greys, pastel blues. Quite industrial materials seem to be around a lot.
That's all before I hand back to Aled in the London studio for a look back at the life's work of Gerald Cinnamon. And we'll be giving a taste of next week's coverage from Lisbon's Triennale. All that and more on Section D, here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. I'm in Paris at the four-day trade fair Maison et Objet. Founded in 1995, I am one of 85,000 visitors who come here twice a year to see the great and the good of the world's homeware brands. There's 3,000 exhibitors here, showing off the newest furniture, lighting, textiles and bathroom wares, 45% of which are international. It's a vital showcase of what's going to be going on over the next 6 months in our homes, and of course, in our shops. To kick things off, Monocle researcher Josh Fennett is at London retailer and manufacturer SCP's stand, chatting to founder Sheridan Coakley.
Like normal, we haven't got any groundbreaking materials or techniques. We're quite traditional in what we do. We just try and use the materials that are traditional materials in interpreting things in a kind of contemporary way to make things fit into the way we live now. So what have we got? We've kind of reinvented the beanbag, or the beanbag which was designed in the 1970s, and try to kind of make it into more of an interesting object rather than something which you buy your kids to take to college with. And Donna Wilson has designed a new textile which she's had knitted in wool, and it's then pressed and steamed and turned into a beanbag.
Will the beanbag become more respectable? Is it finding its way back into...
You know, you've got to admit, they're really comfortable, actually. And apart from that, they're quite practical. I mean, now they're interesting objects with the fabric that we're using. I think they look like an interesting thing. I hope that, well, respectable, just kind of making people look at it again.
And talking for the interview, you've got a very busy week coming up at London Design Week. Can you tell us a little bit about your plans?
Well, we're showing this collection here that we're launching in Paris, plus three exhibitions of American design company called Lostine, who are a Philadelphia-based, slightly crafty type of products, a lot of wood and leather. Then we're showing Roland Hill, the American Brooklyn-based lighting company, their new range, or some of their new products and some of their established products, and American Design Club, AMDC, which is a kind of loose collective of young American designers who usually, as a rule, tend to design and make their own products.
So what's exciting about the American design scene at the minute?
It's exciting because it's kind of been neglected, and you know, they've been kind of beavering away for the last 10 or 15 years, and it's been emerging, and it's kind of hasn't been picked up over here. And you go to America, or you go to New York, and the little stores are full of really interesting American designed and usually American made products, you know, a bit like how it was in the UK in the mid 80s, when Ron Arad and Tom Dixon and Jasper Morrison, they all came up as a kind of emerging designers had no market, so they tended to become designer makers.
And just one final question, how is that kind of that sort of nascent American idyllic sounding design, how's that influence your collection here?
Well, we've got two designs here which by American designers. We've got the ceramics by with designs by the American illustrator Mark McGuinness, which we've had made in Stoke on Trent, and a light by Beck Britton, who's a Brooklyn-based. She's a lighting designer and manufacturer, but we're producing this in the UK.
From a British firm with its eyes on the American market, we head across Hall 8 to see how a Korean designer, Studio 22, are combining sculpture with architecture to create everything from clocks to jewellery, all from concrete.
This year we bring to Paris our new product. It's a set of 10 grand city sculpture. It's seven small buildings grow up from 10 grand puzzles. So you can arrange them and to create a unique city skyline.
They're beautiful, so just to explain to people, they're probably about 6 inches tall, made of concrete, and they can be reassembled to form sort of cityscape. So where did the idea come from to manufacture them?
Our material is concrete, so it's a very city and urban material. So we always like to combine these ideas and also urban life into our products. So I think to create a city skyline is a very a nice image for us. Yeah.
And what's the benefit of working with concrete? What do you find rewarding about it?
It's a kind of a new material to products. So we start with the concrete rings and we make by ourselves. So by the time it goes on, we develop some techniques of this material. So we think the material of our quality is a little bit better than others. So we think it makes our product more unique than others.
And finally, concrete could come across as being a bit dated, a bit kind of 60s and 70s, or a bit drab. Well, why do you think it's the future?
I just think it's interesting because it's a very artificial material. So people have a lot of like stereotype to this material, and we use the stereotype to put new designs on it. I think it's very interesting.
Continuing on with the concrete theme, we caught up with German manufacturers Mensch Made, whose innovative use of the material has cemented a theme at this year's fair.
My name is Doreen Westphal. I live in Holland and my company is called Mensch Made. And on my stand I show mainly living accessories made from concrete. We have some egg cups where we hide magnets in the egg cup, so the spoon always sort of sticks to the egg cup. And we have a lot of candle holders, and a lot of people like our new tables, which are really textured with lace pieces and other textures.
So I've seen quite a lot of concrete today. Is that a kind of emerging trend, you'd say, that people are using concrete to create things which maybe don't seem like they should be made out of concrete, like, say, a desk organizer or the egg cups I can see here? What's the reason concrete's become more popular?
In the last years, there has been a big jump in development of concrete. Some new innovations and patents are registered on concrete, on the mix. And you can more and more build or make things from concrete finer and finer. And that's also what I play with. Like, I have these cufflinks with a Baroque surface. It's just looking for where it ends in the detail. In architecture, you can, with this concrete, with 30 or 40% less, you can build just as high as and strong. And I like to play with it in living accessories.
So there's no irony in using concrete, which is kind of quite a bulky medium, to do things which are very fine and very refined. There's no irony in that. It's actually because you find it a strong material to work with and you think it's easy to utilize.
Yeah, it's different than working with ceramics. Your molds are different. But if you look back, like the Romans, they used it for their first settlements, and they made benches from it, and then it disappeared, and now it's coming back. And again, I made bench, but it's so fine, and I like the connection to the very old, but also looking forward and looking for how far you can go. And I also did the research some years ago, if you make something from concrete or you make it from ceramics, is there an environmental input? Is it different? And the result was that you use 50 times less energy making a vase from concrete than making the same vase from ceramics. And even though concrete is fired when it comes out of the earth, but it's a much larger amount than firing piece by piece of the ceramic vases. So I was quite amazed of the energy savings you can have with concrete.
Next, Monocle's Josh Fennett caught up with the organisers at the Danish Crafts Collection to discuss why the conservative Danes have plumped for a more colourful collection this year.
I'm Bo Koldi, I'm from Danish Craft, and we're here at the Danish Crafts Collection stand in Paris.
We are indeed. I was wondering if you could talk me through a couple of the products. We've seen some lovely stoneware pots over there. Could you tell me a little bit about those?
Yes, and we have a coffee jock, which is a prototype, and then we have the cups that comes with it in three different sizes and in different colours as well, all handmade in Denmark.
And how would you define the sort of direction that the Danish craft is going in? What are some of the themes, the hallmarks of this year?
This year we have nature. We have a lot of natural products. We have people going back. You could say that the Danish Crafts Collection is always about the typical or the classical Danish principles of functionality and good craftsmanship. That's what we're trying to show here. So we have a lot of wood as well, as you can see. And we have stoneware, we have glass. And then we try to give it a modern twist.
So can you show us any of the modern twists? I can see, what are these things just here ahead of me? Can you describe them?
That's a hook, okay. Where you can put it on your wall. You can see this is mounted on a wall. And it's made by Wiebke von Speck-Schmidt. And it's actually prototypes. You want to find someone to produce them. But that's, you could say, it's sort of reinvention of the hook.
That was Monocle's Josh Fennett reporting from this year's Maison et Objet Design Fair in Paris.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back, and for those just joining us, you're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris. I'm in Paris at biannual design fair Maison et Objet, currently in hall number 8. It's here where most of the world's best contemporary design brands gather. As you might expect, it's not short of Nordic designers, with Finnish textile manufacturer Marimekko presenting one of the most eye-catching stalls. Its stand is crowned by a series of stitched clouds, made out of one of Marimekko's latest prints, which takes its inspiration from the Finnish weather.
Hi, I'm Maya Walden. I'm here representing Marimekko.
So could you talk us through, it's an absolutely beautiful, beautiful stall here you've got with these amazing strips of fabric with the new collection. Could you just talk us through the whole concept behind what you've got at the show?
The concept we're launching this autumn is a tribute to Finnish weather phenomena in all of its variety.
I mean, if you could just sort of describe for me just some of the fabrics and things in particular, these amazing sort of landscapes you've got with the skies and the greens. That's something quite, I mean, it's a real sort of natural touch there, the sort of watercolours. Quite a sort of slightly new thing for Marimekko.
In Marimekko, we have always respected the nature and we have appreciated in all of its differences. This time, the designers have wanted to describe the Finnish weather phenomena in many different ways and in many different colours, from the sunny day to a stormy day and so on.
I'm just picking up on that. We've got some lovely ceramics there with the sort of yellow that's from the sun, and they're much more of the stormy sort of blue colours of right. The water. Mm-hmm. That's a real sort of, I mean, obviously a very Marimekko thing, but very Finnish as thin as well, just to really react to nature with design, isn't it?
The nature is very, very important for Finns and for Marimekko.
So how's the show been for you so far? I mean, it's not long into it, but...
It's been very good so far.
Yeah.
We have great expectations on this show. This is one of our main shows for Marimekko during the year.
How important is Maison for you? I mean, it's a way of really reaching out to the international buying community and press community as well, isn't it?
Yes, it's one of the most important fairs for us. For interior, definitely the most important. To meet the press and the existing customers and also to get some new contacts.
We're back in Hall 3 at Maison et Objet. We're at a stand with Itala, which started out life as a glass factory in Finland but has slowly moved into more homewares. And the brand's actually at this edition taking a bit more of a leap into New Frontiers. I'm here with, would you like to introduce yourself and could you just sort of tell me a bit more about what you've got at this year's Maison?
My name is Siru Nori. I work with the communications of Iittala in Helsinki, and this fall we are bringing, basically we are bringing Iittala from the kitchen and dining table towards living room and towards the other rooms in the house, which is quite a natural step for us. Iittala has been for decades very strong on tableware, on dinnerware, and that's of course where our roots lie. But we have had interior objects such as the ambient light products with candles and of course the Aalto collection, which is classic since 1937. So it's quite logical that we take the whole concept one step forward. Yeah. So this fall we are bringing electric lights as an addition to our collection. Harri Koskinen has designed a new electronic version of the lantern, which is already quite a modern classic. And then we have a new fantastic young talented designer, Magnus Pettersen, who works in London. And he has designed this Leimu lamp for us that really nicely shows the combination of concrete and glass together as a fantastic combination of materials.
Yeah, and this beautiful, it's sort of cognac coloured with a sort of hand-blown glass top with a concrete base. One other new sort of step for the brand is this, again, working with a new designer for you.
Yes.
Moving into storage, which just sort of describe this lovely object.
Yes, part of the interior concept that we are going deeper into is also storage, not that just lamps. And we are bringing up a Finnish designer couple, Klaus Aalto and Elina Aalto, who make together a design company Aalto plus Aalto. And they have made us a wonderful storage solution on plywood, which is very traditional material in Scandinavia, like it is in Baltics and Russia. We, in the old towns, we used to have a lot of products out of bent and pressed plywood. Mm-hmm. So as a very natural material, it's a logical step also for us to bring a new temporary solution for storing things at home. The idea behind is that normally when you have sort of unpleasant things at home that you want to chuck somewhere, you put it in a cardboard box or an ice box and it goes back to the back of the storage room.
Yeah.
But with Vaka, we want to sort of show and prove that storage can be also a beautiful part of the interior design. It can be a bedside table, a table next to your chair or sofa, but it still stores things inside. You can stack it, you can make combinations like you want, you can combine colors or just use plain white storage towers. So it gives quite a lot of options for you to use. Put papers away, newspapers into one box and have it, or make a whole pile and wonderful.
And do it beautifully. Yeah. And there's also this beautiful sort of thick grey felt bag, which is again, I guess, a storage solution, but also a really beautiful one. Could you just sort of talk to us a bit through about this bag?
Well, we have had a pleasure on having Harri Koskinen as our design director since the beginning of 2012, and he is of course a fantastic asset to Iittala.
Yeah.
Not only did he sort of insert the electricity and redesign his classic lantern for that, but he also designed us another kind of softer temporary solution, a meno bag. Meno in Finnish means to go.
Yeah.
And so that kind of describes the product in a nice way. So it's a storage felt, industrial felt product that you can either store things at home, or it has handles that you can take it with you. Yeah. So basically you can put your ski gear in there, have it nicely in your living room, and when it's time to go skiing and the weather is good, you just grab it and take it with you. So that's kind of the idea behind it.
And it looks great in the process. What's the sort of been, I mean, we're only a few hours into the fair, what's the reception been like so far for these sort of, you know, slightly newer items you're doing?
I think sort of the primary reaction from people that I've heard, this is of course my perception only, not relying on any data, but the initial reaction is that it's about time. You know, that it is, people see it just like we do. That is, it's a very natural step for Iittala, and it's something that fits our portfolio quite nicely. And especially the lighting is something that has sort of spontaneously given us the feedback that it is the right direction to go, and we strongly believe in that. We are an interior brand, really.
And do you think it's this sort of diversification will extend over the next couple of years?
For sure, for sure. We are strongly focusing on taking the collection, not of course forgetting the big and good solid base that we have in the dining and dining category, but also definitely on the interior side. So it is a strategic step for us, and I'm sure that we will continue to see interesting novelties in the future as well.
I think it's paying off. Siri, thank you very much. We're joined by Alicia Kirby, contributing editor of Monocle. Alicia, talk me through, there's a lot to see here. Have you noticed any trends from everything you've seen here today?
Well, I've noticed that the trend from last season of pastel colours is still quite strong. So a lot of ceramic ware in pastel pinks, pastel greys, pastel blues, that seems to still be very popular, especially in crockery and that kind of thing. Even brands like Le Creuset have got on it with their new colour being a kind of mottled bluey grey. Quite industrial materials seem to be around a lot.
Yeah, you've got sort of the softness of the pastels, but then also a lot of concrete things coming through.
So concrete used in contrast with glass at Itala in a lamp, which is quite interesting because Itala, a Finnish company, traditionally a glassware company, but they're moving and expanding out into interiors. So their lamp by a young Norwegian designer is concrete and glass contrast. So that was interesting. And then you get other materials such as cork being used again in contrast with glass in lamps, vases, that kind of thing. But also Portuguese knife company we came across had partnered with Amarim, a Portuguese cork manufacturer, to make knives with cork handles. So that was quite interesting. Another interesting material actually was the move away from traditional plastics to celebrating, I guess, silicone, which seems to be everywhere and is being touted as the material of the future because it's non-toxic and it's heat-proof. So being used in everything from nutcrackers at Danish brand Norman Copenhagen to the kind of patterns on the tableware by German company Click. I was talking to a Taiwanese designer who was actually formerly an aerospace engineer designing fighter crafts in Taiwan. And he just launched a purely silicone made kitchenware. So saucepans made from silicone with a metal base and also kettles, and had just won the Red Dot Design Award. And he was celebrating the use of silicone basically as the material of the future to be used in every industry from medical to aerospace to car manufacturing. So that was interesting.
We saw him in a section devoted to Taiwanese design. I mean, there's a lot of international brands that come to Maison. What is the sort of the appeal if you're a new young manufacturer from around the world? Why is Maison the show to be showing at?
I think it's got young designers, you know, very seasoned, the big names like Philippe Starck, Jean-Marie Massot. You've got the big furniture brands, but then you've also got independent brands. I think it's ripe for discovery, even though it's a fair that's been around for a long time. And you've got every single buyer from around the world, especially within Europe, under one roof. So the exposure for an independent brand is great.
Any particular favourite things you've seen today from your personal taste?
Ooh, well, I saw some beautiful pepper grinders at Norman Copenhagen with a kind of oak body and a marble top. I saw a lovely kind of architectural kind of dollhouse almost that was very minimal, very clean for kids, but also for adults. And they've been approached by MoMA and other various stores. It was the first day of their launch today. So that was very interesting. And then Marimekko celebrated nature with a collection of ceramics kind of daubed with greens and blues and very kind of earthy products. It was quite a departure for them because normally it's very strong what they do. It was quite a departure for them and an interesting one at that.
Still to come in part two, Aled John in London will take over the helm for the remainder of the show with reports on the life and works of typographer and book designer Gerald Cinnamon. We'll be reviewing a photo book on the changing architecture of Olympic cities and re-preview next week's coverage of the Lisbon Triennale with a trip to the Aga Khan Awards. That's it from us in Paris. Over to you, Aled.
Thanks, Tom, and the rest of the team in Paris. Welcome back to Section D, now coming to you from Midori House in London. I'm Aled John in the chair for the rest of the show. Say graphic design and Switzerland might not be the first thing that comes to mind. However, Swiss-style design is precisely the source of inspiration for a new exhibition, debuting this week in London's Institute of Contemporary Art. Following the pioneering work from 1958 onwards of American award-winning typographer and book designer Gerald Cinnamon, the ICA will display a collection of his works as the chief designer of Penguin Publishing House's paperback typology, posters and art titles. To explore how Gerald took inspiration from Swiss-style design and applied it to the literary world for well over 20 years, Monocle's Alexa Firmanich caught up with the curator of the exhibition, Matt Williams, last week.
We are currently standing in the Edward Fox Reading Room, which is a space that the ICA used to put on displays related to different books, different designers. Maybe historically they might be artists, might be graphic designers, might be artist collectives. And at the moment we're standing in front of the D. Gerald Cinnamon exhibition, which is a selection of works by Gerald, who was a freelance graphic designer before moving to Penguin. He worked at Penguin for a number of years up until 1985, from the late 60s. And since then has written a number of different books, but also continued his practice. And so the ICA are very pleased to be presenting an exhibition of his book designs and other related materials from that time frame. Swiss design kind of has, you know, was very much developed during a kind of modernist period. It was a reaction to kind of the everyday, and was used to kind of basically clarify information and make it universal, so basically people could kind of understand and recognize. I mean, it's also kind of closely related, I guess. You know, I always consider, when thinking of Swiss design, the Helvetica design, which is a very common typeface. And, you know, it's used, obviously there's the kind of Microsoft Word interpretation there, which is Arial. But basically Swiss design developed as a way, as a means of kind of informing, providing information to the masses. And it was very clean, very bold, very kind of strict in its kind of use of fonts and the variety of fonts that it would use as well. So basically it was quite revolutionary in the 60s. Obviously you still had a kind of typesetting process of publishing, but this is something that Gerald Cinnamon adopted at a very early stage, along with a number of other designers. But he basically, maybe from his experience of being taught at Bard or something, was aware of this style of language, visual language. And yeah, Jerry was one of the, you know, adopted it wholesale, which you can see in a number of different publications and the book designs that he put together and the lettering and for Penguin.
Was he one of the first people to really pick up on this sort of style back then? And do we still see a lot of it now, or have things evolved?
Yeah, we definitely still see it in today's design. I mean, it's, you know, people often borrow quite heavily from this period, and you know, I still purchase books with feature Swiss design because it has such an elegance to it and such a simplicity in use of both forms and text and colour that it's very engaging material.
And I mean, it's a very sort of crisp type of design. I see a lot of these books are actually taken up by photographs, and the titles of the books, for example, over here, they're mostly about the image itself.
Yeah, well, he very much kind of allowed the image to breathe, and it's very much this idea of piecing the text with the image, which he certainly was a pioneer. So in some of the layouts here, you'll see that his use of images and next to the text, which was kind of relatively unheard of. But Jerry very much always thought of the composition of the image and how the image responds to the text. And, you know, often would get the copy editors to actually alter the text to fit the image rather than the other way around, which is relatively which is quite bold, but obviously he had a very strong relationship with the copy editors. Also, he was responsible for designing the Style and Civilization Pelican book series for Penguin and the Pelican History of Art. And so it was important to me that I wanted to kind of group some of these together, because these were hugely influential books, and these were books that people, you know, engaged with during the 70s and 80s until, you know, the new editions. But they basically took on a certain kind of form and structure, which Jerry, you know, was very much, you know, a key influence of. And he came from Penguin, and prior to his appointment there, I'm going to mispronounce his name, Jan Tischold. He's a fantastic designer. That books have been published with Hyphen Press, for example, and Robin Kinross has taken a keen interest in his work. And so he was at Penguin for a couple of years, and then it was a the chief designer was Hans Schmoller, who Jerry actually designed a book about Hans Schmoller, and which you know is available to purchase online. And he and Jerry continued this kind of very rigorous approach to typesetting, to basically page design. And Penguin, you know, was renowned in a very positive sense of producing books that were legible, easy to engage with, but also, you know, offered the reader the opportunity to engage with the images next to the text. So this alignment and this kind of juxtaposition was very key, and something that Jerry was certainly influential.
The ICA's Matt Williams talking to Alexa Firmenich there. Lots more coming up after this short break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage, and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delorme.
From Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
For Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dan.
For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Alan John. The Olympic City is an ongoing photography project by photographer John Pack and documentary filmmaker Gary Hustwit. Looking at the legacy of the Olympic Games, they visited former host cities around the world since 2008 to find out what happens after everyone leaves. Their first book, released last month, documents sites that have been retrofitted and transformed, standing as testaments to careful urban planning and smart architecture. But it also shows other sites, the ones that sit unused for decades, reflecting the broken promises of the benefits the Games would bring. Pauline Eifman met the two photographers in New York.
I was never a fan of the Olympics. My wife is a huge fan, and so she always had it on in 2008 when the Beijing Olympics happened. And I just noticed that everyone was talking about the amount of money that was being spent on the facilities and the crazy architecture they were building. So it just got me wondering, you know, what happens to all this stuff they're building after the Olympics leaves. And so I decided to rent a car and just drive up to Lake Placid and Montreal and check it out. And that's where it started, really, in 2008.
And what did you see at Lake Placid?
It's a kind of the opposite of Beijing. You know, it's a little village of 5,000 people that they've hosted the Olympics twice.
One of the interesting things in Lake Placid was the town couldn't afford to build new housing for the athletes. They couldn't afford to build an Olympic village for the 1980 games, but they found out they could get money to build a prison. So they built a new prison and then housed the athletes in it. And then once the games were over, the prisoners moved on in. So that's one of the more interesting afterlives of an Olympic facility that we've seen.
Yeah.
I think some countries showed up early to kind of check out the facilities and saw the prison. I mean, they're literally in prison cells with bunk beds and stuff. And the countries went, no, we think we're going to look at our own, rent our own luxury villas and house our athletes. But all the American athletes stayed in the prisons, and a lot of the officials did too.
So can you summarize maybe the countries that you've been to over the years and maybe the places that have surprised you the most?
We went to Moscow, Helsinki, Sarajevo, Rome, Athens, Beijing, Barcelona, Mexico City, Los Angeles, Montreal, Lake Placid, and London. Those were the cities for this phase of it. There's so many more cities that have hosted the games, but we just couldn't fit them all into one book. I mean, there's a huge range just in the ones we covered. You know, John went to Sarajevo, which, of course, has an Olympic afterlife, but then, you know, after the Bosnian War, it just has a completely other dimension to it.
So the pressure is mounting for the final heat. Wolfgang Huppe is our leader. Remember, unheralded coming into the games, the youngest of the East German drivers, having a tremendous Olympic performance. 51.06 was his time. After the third heat, his brakeman, Dietmar Schomerhauer, a former 100-meter sprinter. They know they have to have a good run as they come down this hill.
Most of the places we're going to, we're seeing just the afterlife of the Olympics. But in Sarajevo, I went to the bobsleigh and luge venue, and it was used during the Bosnian War as trenches, you know, for Serbian guerrillas. So there are holes poked through the cement every 20 feet or something. You know, everywhere you look, you can't walk more than a few feet without being reminded of the war. You know, that's really the main thing there. You know, during the war, they're running out of wood for coffins. So they were using the bleacher seats from the Olympics. So they're really intertwined, the Olympics and the war, that history is really there. But everything was being used, not for its intended purpose originally, I think, but everyone was, you know, picnicking and camping out at the ski jumps, and, you know, there were skateboarders and graffiti artists on the luge, you know.
I was going to say, it's interesting to see how each city either really needed these kind of buildings and structures, or if they were just sort of built to host this two-week party of the Olympics.
Citizens of the world, for the second time in 108 years, Greece stands before you as host country of the greatest celebration of humanity, with a sense of solemn pride and responsibility.
If you look at Athens, there's dozens of these beautiful stadiums and structures, and, you know, Santiago Calatrava did all these amazing archways, and there it's a ghost town. Basically, they put chain link fence around it, and nothing has happened to it in the past 9 years. So,
I think 21 of the 22 venues are not used at all, and are just roped off and guarded. They keep the press out.
And so in terms of the actual architecture, have you seen some things that have worked better than others, or some things that just every time they were done, they just couldn't be reused?
The bird's nest in Beijing is just a perfect example of that. It's just too big for any use that they could put to it on a daily basis for the city. So it's a tourist attraction. That's all it is. I mean, you can pay $10 and ride a Segway around the track inside, and then in the winter, they fill it with snow and have like a snow festival. But there was no real plan. And if you're China, you don't really need a plan afterwards. They accomplished what they wanted to, which was to have Beijing be the center of the world for those 2 weeks.
And in terms of the process of actually going there and photographing, how long do you usually spend there? I saw that there was also portraits as well as, you know, more architectural shots. How do you kind of limit yourselves in the assignment?
We ended up doing 10 days to a couple weeks in each city. Sometimes some cities we returned to a couple of times. And we wanted it to be really about the city and its people after the Olympics, what sort of the ghosts that remain. But we didn't want it to just be ruin porn. There's plenty of that, and there's plenty of that around, like people, you know, it's a popular thing right now. We're really interested in getting a feel for these cities.
I mean, a lot of times we would just meet people who were either living in these places, like if the Olympic Village in Montreal was turned into, you know, condos, like luxury condos, and still like a really desirable place to live. And, you know, John just ran into some 90-year-old guy out front who had been living there since 76, since the games, and, you know, to strike up a conversation. And, you know, people a lot of times want to talk about it, and they want to talk about what their connection to the Olympics was or what their memories of it were. So, yeah, we tried to kind of look at these areas of the city and look at the structures, but also kind of try to portray the lives of the people. It's a little bit of a treasure hunt too. I mean, you're looking for signs of the Olympics and that there may be 40 or 50 or 60 years ago. And a lot of times they're right there in front of people's eyes, but they don't realize that that statue or that building or that bridge or things that are even more invisible, like infrastructure, like subway lines and roads. And there's a lot of development that goes on for an Olympic Games that is not just the stuff that we think of, the stadiums and the things that are really visible. I mean, a lot of times cities take that opportunity to really make a huge improvement. Barcelona is a great example of that. They did, 40 years of infrastructure planning that they'd already been, that had been on the books and they really wanted to do, but they didn't have the money to do it. And they were able to for the game, so they redeveloped the port, and you know, it's now a huge tourist attraction to go down to the beach and kind of reconnected the city with the water. Mm-hmm. You know, in that case, it's turned out really well. But in other cities, it's a little harder to see.
And what about temporary architecture and design? Is that something that would be interesting?
Oh yeah, I mean, I, again, it's something that London did in 2012, and I think should be kind of expanded because these don't need to be permanent structures in a lot of cases. But I mean, is the case with Athens, every single one of them was a massive permanent structure, no matter what it was. The beach volleyball courts and the, just every single sport ended up having its own massive permanent structure, which is totally unnecessary. So you would think that someplace like Sochi would have learned that and not done so many massive permanent venues, but hopefully the next cities, Rio.
We met some architects, I think, in Rio who said that they were doing that. They did some for the London, I forget which the architect from, but I think in London, they did 6 or 7 venues that were broken down and sold. They had different countries buying these venues. Rio, I think, was one of them.
It's such a better idea. It's so much more fun. You can have these venues in the middle of the city. You can really kind of integrate the games into the urban fabric. And 2 weeks later, just break it down. I mean, I think all the venues should be temporary venues like that. I think it's much more exciting from a viewer standpoint to kind of see the square that they walk through every day to work. Suddenly, it's like a beach volleyball venue. I mean, I think that's awesome.
And for that, I want to say thank you. Thank you to the people who built the stadiums, the people who created a new neighborhood in an old city, the people who stood guard to keep us safe.
Photographer John Pack and documentary filmmaker Gary Hustwit talking to our Pauline Eiferman there. Next week, Section D is all about architecture. We're heading to Lisbon for the city's Architecture Triennale. As one of the few architectural accolades given to projects after they have already spent some time in use, the Aga Khan Award for Architecture, held this year in Lisbon and presented every 3 years, prioritises impact on communities as well as design excellence. This year's winners, including a Moroccan bridge and an Islamic cemetery in Austria, stay true to that purpose, as Simon Tarek discovers at last week's ceremony in Lisbon, Portugal.
With the Portuguese President and His Royal Highness himself in attendance, the grand opening ceremony of the Aga Khan Architectural Award in Lisbon's medieval São Jorge Castle saw the country's elite shoulder-rubbing in black tie while enjoying concerts and canapés. The sights of the 5 winning projects, however, are a far cry from the pomp of this evening's celebrations. Picked from a short list of 20 out of a total 500 original entries from Muslim societies across the world, they champion the spaces used by ordinary people. From a medical centre in Darfur that reuses 6-metre-long construction containers to an Islamic cemetery blending oak and reinforced concrete in Altach, Austria, the winners, as London-based architect and judge David Ajay tells me, all have people at the heart of their briefs.
Some of the sites that we were talking about have geopolitical sensitivity about them, but we felt that as architects, and that is what we are brought in to do, that what we were talking about was the quality of the built realm and the quality of execution on all levels of these projects. And independent of their geopolitical sensitivity, we were very happy to champion projects that really rigorously we're not about any politicizing of any agenda, but we're about improving the stakeholder opportunity and quality of the user, the citizen, the civic citizen. I sort of feel as an architect and all the other professionals that were in the jury, artists, sociologists, that this was paramount. This is what we're here to do. And, you know, you may have a war going on in a certain situation, but people still have to live. And how do we make that quality of life relevant is really important. And I think that that it trumps any political agenda that may be in any context.
One of the more talked about projects was the revitalization of an historic center in Berzeit, Palestine, that will eventually encompass 50 villages. The five-year project, part of a rehabilitation master plan, restored the decaying core of a rural village and engaged the community in creating public space out of aging structures. Khaldun Beshada, director of Ramallah's Riwak Center of Architectural Conservation, explains.
So Birzeit shows us a possibility how people could intervene in their space and hence meaning-making of their lives. And so I think Birzeit project was successful in different terrains, especially the what we call it cultural infrastructure. Cultural infrastructure where you overcome all the barriers, whatsoever. If they are infrastructural, you get over them. If they are employment, you get over them. I remember this one project, which is called the Hosh al-Atim, which means the courtyard of darkness. Yeah, and it's called like that because it's really dark. And it used to be the dump place in the historic center. And we worked this place into an art residency. We cleared tens of cubic meters, tens of trolleys of rubbish and dampness and vegetation growth and crumbling walls and vaults, and refurbished into five studios where you can host planners and artists for Birzeit University. And this for us was the opening moment. Like you are having an activity in the what used to be the rubbish dump, made people think again their space. And they thought, my God, this even looked better the 50 years ago. Now it's better than when it was in use, actually. And we try in Riwak to put contemporary architecture inside the restoration projects to allow people think beyond the box. Like restoration is not about like making museums and protecting stones, because the project was not about stones, about the kind of life that people dream about. So this was a moment where we realized that people, they can change their mind and they can see opportunities and look things which used to be an obstacle as a place of opportunity.
French architect Marc Mimrem, behind the Rabat Saleh Bridge that links the two Moroccan cities, also saw an opportunity to create a people-focused hub out of what was primarily a brief to improve mobility. The space both above and below the bridge, which has a thin profile and acts as an impressive horizontal extension of an existing plateau, combined to form an urban location in an area subject to rapid growth.
So the historical situation is great in Rabat because we have the mausoleum, and then the geographical situation is fantastic because we are in between the river and the sea. And all that becomes a challenge. We said, okay, the bridge should not be the bridge, but should be the link. And the link in between the two sides of the city, one which is considered the poorest part of the city and the other one which is the rich. So a bridge is always gapping a border. In that case, the border was not only historical, geographical, but social. So how could it become a positive public space? So we took the fact that the bridge would be not too high, but not cutting the city in two pieces, and making under the bridge a market, using the bridge as a roof, so that the people will share the space instead of being separated in two sides. One side is positive, the other one is negative. In that case, now it becomes a public space shared by everybody. During the night, it's fantastic because the people are either all walking under the bridge or using it as a sport facilities, because they can play whatever they want during the night. They have the light and they have it. But I would like them to prepare it to become a market so that the people can come here and sell and buy. And so you can see that it's exactly the contrary of what it was supposed to be as a bridge. We use the workers there to develop their skillness. And it's very interesting because it's two things are completed. One is that it's not low profile. We are not using bricks and we are not using low material. We are using very high technology materials, and we are using it, adding to that a very high knowledge of the craftsmanship. So it's the progress could be positive. My idea is that modernity can be generous and not only fighting against radicality or something like that. So it's a new transformation between in the relationship between infrastructure and landscape, geography, landscape, horizon, light, the vibration of the light, because the link is north-south, so the light will move during the day. So how can we be attentive to the situation, attentive to the people? And the challenge will be that the people will take that for themselves.
As we wait until 2016 for the next roster of innovative projects that catch the eyes of the Aga Khan Award judges, it is safe to say that this year its mandate for celebrating quality of life through quality architecture has been met. For Monocle in Lisbon, I'm Saima Tariq.
Thank you, Saima, and I'll be decamping to Portugal to bring you a Lisbon Architecture Triennale special for next week's show. Thanks to Tom Morris and Josh in Paris, and Holly Fisher, of course, here in London for her production. You can contact me, the producer of the show, Alad, at awj@monocle.com if you want to get in touch with the team behind the show. And a song in honour of the guys in France, this is a big beaded horn blast of a tune from 1968. This is Jacqueline Taieb with Le Coeur au bout des doigts. Thanks for tuning in. Goodbye. Look out.